Good afternoon, Mr. Sabella. Thank you so much for speaking with me. If I can, I'd like to ask you first to talk a little bit about your background, some of the previous jobs that you've held, and how you've come to your current position.
Well, basically, I'm an attorney by training. I've worked previously as an attorney, doing mostly corporate and commercial real estate. In Liberia, I've worked basically in the presidency, starting off working on GMAP and then port sector reform. And then presently, I'm heading the program delivery unit, which is basically responsible for, you know, driving and coordinating delivery on top presidential priorities.
When did you take over the responsibility of leading the reforms in the port sector?
About 2008. That's when that project started.
What was your mandate?
Well, basically it was to drive the reform process, you know, come up with a clear, you know, method for reforming the port, and then drive it until it's achieved. In this case, it was a public-private partnership that we decided upon after the analysis, and we basically worked on everything from the beginning of, you know, the designing the project, consulting with prospective, you know, public-private partners, or private partners, and then, you know, tendering out, evaluating bids, negotiations, and ultimately, you know, handover of the concession of the ports, or at least the aspects of the port that were concessioned to the successful or to the company that ultimately became the concessionaire.
What were some of the options you considered? You mentioned that you eventually selected a public-private partnership, a landlord model for for the port. What were some of the other options you considered?
Well, obviously the options that present themselves are those, you know, that are already there, or at least are readily identifiable. One of them obviously is that can the government itself just fix it up and run it?
Yeah.
But of course, because of the resource constraints, you know, the government's budget at that time was close to $90 million funding, and we had restrictions in terms of borrowing with the HIPIC. The constraints basically, you know, pointed towards some kind of public-private partnership. So the analysis was focused most on what kind of public-private partnership you do. Do you do which portion of the ports do you enter a partnership with? Do you do the entire port? Do you do just the cargo handling? Do you do just the container handling? You know, how do you structure? Also, the questions that we had to address revolved around, well, do you do a deal where the government pays for the major piece of infrastructure, or does that end up being included? And so there's a whole range of things surrounding how do you actually do a public-private partnership. In the final analysis, the decision was dictated by one, as I said, the large cost of the major piece of infrastructure, because usually what happens in public-private partnerships is that, I mean, the ideal case is that the government basically builds a project, and it involves the private partner more or less to manage it and then to share the revenue. That's essentially how it works. So they're bringing their expertise to the table. That's what usually, you know, they look for. Under some circumstances, and it's becoming more and more often, they look for a partner that brings money to the table, that brings capital to the table to undertake major, you know, improvements or rehabilitation. And that was basically our case, where we had major need for capital to be infused into the port being rehabilitated to the tune of $150 million or something like that. So we structured it focusing on that rehabilitation and, of course, the services that the private sector brought to the table in terms of managing the port on a day-to-day basis, increasing its efficiency level, and then, of course, service delivery. All that looked at, we considered that a concession focusing on rehabilitation and operation was the way to go.
Who was it? I met with Mr. Paulson at the World Bank, who I understand was involved in brainstorming and strategizing the port reform. Who are some of the other agencies or officials that contributed to this process?
Yeah. speaking of that, I mean, I have to say, without, I mean, a lot of things happened in this process, but one of the things that I would say was indispensable to the success of this project was the World Bank's involvement, and particularly Gylfi Paulsen's involvement, right? Because, and frankly, if it weren't for Gylfi, I think we'd have a lot of difficulty, would have had a lot of difficulties. I really can't see how it would have been possible. I mean, he really, really, in many respects, is a true champion on this project. I mean, unsung, but he is a real champion, and I think he made it possible by making sure that everything that this project needed to succeed was there. Burt Crook as well has to take a lot of credit because he did a lot of work. He basically taught me everything I knew about port. I'd never been to a port before I started this project, and I learned everything from him. He taught me everything I know. And, you know, and they were engaged. They were always here following up. We had a very good working relationship where we had a chance to sit down and discuss ideas. The bank came to the table with a lot of, you know, background knowledge and information. And, you know, while we were discussing, they brought some of their, you know, their experience and expertise to the table, and it made a big difference. The bank also worked along with us to secure, you know, the services of two consultancies, you know, MTBS, Maritime and Transport Business Solutions, and CPCS Transcom, both on the transactional side, in terms of the overall transaction, and on the port reform side. There's the actual reforms going on within the organization of the port and implementing the transaction. So two separate parallel tracks. And we had consultancies working with us on both of those tracks. So that made a big difference because, I mean, obviously they brought a lot of value to the table, but we were in a position to be able to take that information and contextualize it, fit it within the context of what we're doing. So those as well. And then, as I said, I mean, you can't say any of this without saying that the president's backing for the project was critical, because obviously if the president hadn't backed it, I mean, you can basically, you know, kiss it goodbye. It's something that the president believed in. She ensured that everything that was needed in terms of from the government side was available for the project. And there are many other people as well, because the fortunate thing is we did this in a way that we built a lot of good friendships and partnerships, that we brought all the relevant stakeholders together, and the way that it was being implemented give them the confidence. So, for example, the Minister of Finance, from the time Minister Sayer was here to the time that Minister Ngafwan came, they were all supportive, particularly Minister Tamba, Deputy Minister for Revenue. She was very keen, supported the project. That made a big difference. The Minister of Transport, they were involved. We have people from the Ministry of Justice who are involved. So all these agencies collectively came to the table with their different bits of, you know, contributions. The NRC, for example, under the chairmanship of Richard Tolbert, former Nadebe's predecessor, all those people were instrumental in terms of bringing it all together, bringing all the different government agencies that needed to be involved in order to meet the legal requirement. And of course, you know, the technical requirement for getting a deal like this done. So it was a lot of bits and pieces. You know, we just basically were just more or less coordinators. But those people's contributions were very, very instrumental.
To what extent were the NPA and the Bureau of Maritime Affairs, or formerly known as the Bureau of Maritime Affairs, to what extent were they involved in the process?
Well, they were involved from the very beginning. Obviously, when you're concessioning an asset, under the law, those agencies have to be very much involved. So the MPA was naturally involved from the very beginning, and the BMA wasn't really involved, because this really doesn't relate to Bureau of Maritime Affairs, but it happens in this case that the Bureau of the commissioner, Mr. Kessely, was also the chairman of the board. That's how the BMA got involved. So, but technically the BMA wasn't really involved in the matters of concerning, you know, concession in the port. So that's the link between those people. But again, from the very beginning, and this is where I spoke earlier about the creativity that one needs to bring to the table. Very early on, one realized that it's next to impossible to reform an organization from within. You can't do it. I mean, it's just not possible for so many different reasons, which we can spend 2 days talking about. It's next to impossible. because that culture grows around that organization and the way it is, and it's almost a cult-like thing. You can't change it. They have the people inside to change it. It's difficult.
Are you referring to NPA now?
Or any organization for that matter. I mean, that was the case at NPA. It was difficult to change from within. I mean, so the only way that we determined it was perhaps possible to do it was to have the reform driven from outside. Okay. Informed to a certain extent by, you know, of course, Gilfie's extensive experience with the Bureau of Public Enterprises in Nigeria, where he did a lot of work and were able to succeed because they reformed the organization from outside. Mm-hmm. So we took that mechanism, not exactly the BPE, because they had a whole different outfit for public-private partnership for all state assets, but just a unit dedicated specifically to ports. Okay, so we used that mechanism, and again, taking that, building on that innovation with more innovation. Under the law, when you do concessions, the procurement unit of the agency, the same unit that's supposed to be doing buying pens and papers and things like that, is essentially the unit that will be doing the concession. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't make sense, right? Because this is a highly complex, highly technical thing, and you are giving it to people who don't have any experience in this regard. So that immediately poses a problem. What we were able to do was to structure it so that the port basically had Port Sector Reform Secretariat act as a procurement unit for purposes of this transaction. That's how we're able to put it together, into place the mechanism, working along with the port to drive it on a day-to-day basis, go through, follow up with all the technical requirements for the transaction, pull all the pieces together, all the different consultancies, think through the options, etc., to drive the deal to conclusion.
If I can, taking it a step back for a minute, something I should have asked earlier. Why was the Port Reform Secretariat first created? When was the decision first made to undertake this reform?
The we actually agreed, I think, in December 2007, right? Yeah, that we sat down with all the partners. Everybody agreed that the port was an urgent priority, needed to be done. And to a certain extent, we sat down and said, okay, let's enter an MOU for doing this. And all the partners who would be involved, exactly what involvement, you know, it would be, would specify all of those things in an MOU. So we did an MOU in December 2007, which says, okay, we are moving with the intention of, you know, reforming the port. We'll hire consultancy, X country will bring X, Y country will bring Y organization will bring this. And we basically had a broad blueprint. Of course, everything didn't go according to that plan, but the basic framework was there, that between government and the partners, we agreed that this was something that we wanted to do. Of course, then the secretariat was mentioning as a mechanism that would be in there. Also, we set up a coordination, an interministerial body through this MOU. And then we set up a mechanism for engagement between the interministerial committee, interministerial body, and the donors. So you had all these mechanisms where at the government level, you had one mechanism where the government internally could meet on this. If the issues arose, between the government and partners, you had a mechanism at a higher level for the partners and the government to meet, sort them out, and then trickle down to the secretary. Of course, that's the first thing we did when we started. We drafted and concluded the MOU.
This seems in some way to be a hybrid of the LRDC and the delivery unit. It's in some way a bridge between the...
I was working at the time in the LRDC. When I first started, I started working with NADIB. Okay? So...
Okay. So were you... Was the Port Reform Secretariat technically part of the LRDC?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. That's exactly. So technically, LRDC was basically our house agency, or home agency, if you will. Okay. And then, of course, eventually, the secretary kind of had his own separate existence. But yeah, initially it was in the LRDC.
Okay. You mentioned that you prior to this were working on GMAP. Mm-hmm. So GMAP had its own goals, its own mm-hmm. program at the NPA. Mm-hmm. How did the vision that the GMAP vision, in a sense, for the port? What was the relationship between GMAP's plans for the port and the Port Reform Secretariat's plans?
Well, I mean, actually, interestingly, at one point, I was the government's point person on GMAT, okay? And I was also, you know, so I mean, it was easy for me to pair them up, bring them, because I understood GMAT and I understood the port. So it was easy to bring them to reconcile any issues that might be. As a matter of fact, that was one of the critical issues. There was all these reforms that were supposed to be going on in terms of the financial interventions that GMAT was bringing about. When we started talking about the management and organizational reforms that needed to happen, the organizational reform, that had consequence for, you know, the financial administration as well. So the question was, who does what when it comes to that? So of course, some harmonization between the CPCS Transcom consultants that were trying to do that financial, with the new financial framework, and the GMAT people had to be done. And then when we reconciled, that was basically GMAT is for the immediate and short term, and then this is basically visioning and designing what, you know, the mechanisms will look like for the future. And I think we've managed to facilitate decent working relationship between the GMAP and the Port Sector Reform Secretary, which basically I think resulted in a happy result.
Was there any disagreement about the vision for reforms to the port? Was there, did the GMAP, either the GMAP officials at the port or some of the other GMAP stakeholders, the bank, USAID, other GMAP stakeholders, did they have a difference of opinion, or did they differ about, did they have a different vision of the port maybe where it would continue to be government-led?
I don't think there was anybody, no, there, all the donors were on board in terms of the need for the port to be, you know, to be reformed along the lines that it ended up being reformed. I think there was broad, there was always broad support, broad agreement between the government and the partners.
So, or some sort of concession with the...
Yeah, that was basically, that was, matter of fact, that was even enshrined in the memorandum of understanding. So that was clear from the very onset. So, yeah. And then the mechanisms that we set up were deliberate. And they managed, because of those mechanisms, we were able to keep the partners informed in terms of what we're doing, keep the government informed in terms of what we're doing, coordinate between all the different parties. So because I think it boils down to, I think we're fortunate that we're able somehow to manage the process. Process management is critical. If you have all these different players, all these different levels, all these different steps, and you don't manage it carefully, it can result into a big mess. So I think the one fortunate thing that happened to us is that we were able to manage it halfway decent. It made a big difference.
Can you talk a little bit more about the coordination between the GMAP officials and, was it CPC, the Canadian consultancy group?
Yeah.
Because essentially it was up to you to coordinate their activities. So could you talk a little bit more about how you have meetings with all the stakeholders together to explain the process?
Of course. When the CPCS started, I think that we recognized that first thing was there was some confusion, which is the source of all the problems in the world, lack of understanding. There was a lack of understanding about, well, what is it that these people are going to be doing? How does it affect what we are doing? It's always this little territorial thing. Mm-hmm. But I think we were fortunately able to recognize that very early on and said, well, look, instead of waiting, let this thing become something that it doesn't need to be. I mean, it's much ado about nothing, it would basically be. We should intervene and make sure that we facilitate this working relationship on the basis of the understanding that, I mean, this is not competition. I mean, and it helped that I was also involved with GMAP. We were able to say clearly to them, okay, this is your role. This is what the government is asking you to do. This is their role, and this is what the government is asking them to do. There might be some slight overlaps. Because particularly GMAP also had a mandate in a way to say, okay, well, we got to put in place systems that you can use hereafter. But that system that they were putting in place for use hereafter presupposed the MPA as it is or as it was.
Okay.
CPCS's work basically was about designing a financial management mechanism for the MPA as it would be after reform. So we had to clarify that. So once that was clarified, not to say that everything was perfect, but it eased any potential tensions. And then eventually, GMAP had to fade away anyway, because I think we reached a certain point where a lot of things were achieved. The financial management system was at least in some order, so they were able to phase out, and then CPCS's work just took off from there, and I think it kind of worked out.
This may be too broad a question, but how would you assess the performance of the GMAP program at the Ford?
Well, I mean, I think we have some basic objectives. I think in terms of, you know, helping with the financial management system, you know, in terms of the immediate things that needed to be addressed, in terms of bringing some transparency to the transactions, some competency to the kind of work that had to be done, I think there was much contribution in that respect. At a certain point, though, the short-term, quick-impact nature of GMAP was beginning to outlive its usefulness, in the sense that, because we sat and we all agreed, I mean, that was short-term, quick stuff. You get in there, you have a GMAP code controller, and he works and all of this stuff. But now let's start thinking about an organization in the future. Mm-hmm. You can't continue to have this. This is a quick fix, fire brigade action kind of thing. You can't continue to have this perpetually. So we said, let's see how we can adapt GMAP so that the focus is on capacity building, right? Because if you had capacity, because you can bring in a high flying accountant to do this work, that's easy, and pay him X, but that's not sustainable. Because the very day that guy leaves, you go back to where you started if you don't have people who are trained to know some of the things that he knows to take over where he left off. So we started walking down that line, and I think it kind of worked out, generally, on the overall, I think GMAP was successful. And of course, some things happened in terms of how the program phased out, and I think we didn't really continue in the way that we wanted to. But I think if we'd continued with the second phase, which would have emphasized capacity building, I think it would have been, the result would have been better and stronger. But all things considered, I think GMAP served a very useful purpose.
So capacity building was a component of GMAP programs at all SOEs.
It always was, but right. The problem was we never actually got to do much of the capacity building. Mm-hmm. So in the last phase, we were trying to emphasize capacity building. And we got to some of it, you know, there were trainings and things like that, which was good, but we wanted deeper intervention in that respect. We wanted more heavy-hitting capacity building. And I think the intention was to get to that, but I think the program kind of phased out before we got to that point.
So at the end, was capacity building stressed more at the port than at the other SOEs because of the nature of the impending public-private partnership?
Not really. I think we emphasized capacity building everywhere. Okay. All the state of enterprises, we wanted to see as much capacity building as possible. That one was given. That one was straightforward. So no, there was not any particular emphasis at the point, no.
Okay. If I can come back to the concession with APM terminals, what were your priorities in you mentioned the scale of the investment from a potential investor. What were some of the other factors you were looking for?
Well, basically, the concession design was simple. Simple, and it's very easy to understand. One, we had several criteria according to which we judged the winning bidder. One, which one of them was able to reconstruct the key, finance and reconstruct the key in the shortest time possible, okay. Right? And secondly, which one of them was able to give us the best in terms of royalties, or the most in terms of royalties? Finished. That's it.
Okay.
I mean, if you were able to build it quicker and were able to pay us more, fine. Of course, weighted. So it could be a lot of different combinations. But either way, you get to the most points. If you the more of those two things you can do, or more of one of the other. Actually, we weighted rapid reconstruction of the key more because it was urgent. The key is in very bad shape. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to make sure that, I mean, as a matter of strategically, we wanted to make sure that the smart bidder would say, well, look, I can make all the points or a good chunk of my points on, you know, by building the key quickly. Okay, so in the short term, in the medium term, building the key quickly was more important than generating revenues, because frankly, if the quay collapsed, there'd be no revenues to talk about. You see, so yeah, speed of construction of the quay, revenues, okay, or royalties.
What sorts of regulatory authorities does the government retain over the APM?
It's easier to state it this way. What was concessioned? Okay, the concession basically includes one. There's an area in the port called concession area. I think about, I forget exactly how many hectares. I think about 40 hectares altogether. That basically is a concession area. They will basically carry out, let's say, all the day-to-day operations, all the day-to-day operational functions that a port carried out. They would do, you know, general cargo, container cargo. They would service. They would provide towing. Basically, the whole package. And everything else that's not included in that, the MPA would do. Of course, MPA has a vast array of other responsibilities. There are four ports. Still retains responsibility for the other three ports. Still retains responsibility for basically setting tariffs. There's a mechanism detailed in the concession agreement. Retains responsibility for supervision, in a way, of the concessionaire. Somebody has to be there to say, well, you say you're supposed to do this by X time. Mm-hmm. What happened? Or X is not working well. Why is that? Okay? And things like that.
28?
No, I think this is just a reminder for 2 o'clock. I have a two o'clock.
Okay, well, so we'll wrap up quickly.
Yeah. So, just basically, MPA will still continue to exist as a landlord. As a landlord, you have, you know, many things to do. You have to make sure, for example, you dress the port. That was one of the responsibilities that retained, that MPA retained. You have to make sure, for example, that, you know, you have a way of you know, collecting the revenues that are coming to you. If you want to invest those revenues, you can do it. If you want to engage in, I mean, it's a whole range of things. Everything else except the free port of Monrovia, the MPA still has to do, including making sure that the concessionaire does all the things that they have to do. So that's basically the separation between MPA and the other.
Does MPA, two parts to this question. Does MPA have the, does the government have the authority to regulate the fees that the concessionaire charges customers,
yes,
on both sides?
Yes. Yes.
Let me first, one criticism that I've heard is that APM terminals has raised terminal fees. The standard terminal fee, specifically different food products, mm-hmm, rice, frozen foods, they raise the terminal fees on those. Does the government have the ability to negotiate those fees or set a cap of some sort?
Well, I don't know. I've heard that argument myself. The only problem with that argument is most of the people making it haven't read the concession agreement, because APM Terminals does not set tariffs. It does not unilaterally set tariffs. Any tariff that it is imposing now are tariffs that were agreed in the concession agreement. Any subsequent tariff increases will be agreed with the government, with the MPA. So there is no... Everything that is being charged now is being charged by the MPA. But let me just go one step further, because I've heard that quite a bit. The reason why you have to have tariff increases when you do a deal like this, it's not for me, you know. Nothing's free in this world. It seemed like you were getting it cheaper, but you were getting it apparently cheaper at the expense of having no port in the next 3 years. I mean, that's the trade-off. But on a more practical level, there were no food increases on food prices. Mm. We specifically did the calculation, and we know exactly how much is charged for each ton of rice that comes into this country on basic commodities. We did the analysis. It's clear how much can be charged. So there's nothing new on that respect. These things either come in containers or they come as bulk cargo. And we know exactly how much they charge. And when you do the analysis, between then and now, there hasn't been any increase in food prices and basic commodity prices or strategic commodity prices that can be attributed to this concession. if there has been an increase in the price of rice, everybody knows that's because the price of agricultural products has been going up.
Yeah.
Nobody can come and do the math and say, okay, this is attributed to MPS. Matter of fact, immediately after the concession and before we started seeing world food prices go up, the effect of the concession was nil. And it's because, you see, when you look at the whole picture, the savings that you realize, give you for a couple of examples, shipping a container to Liberia, because of all the issues involved, there was perhaps a surcharge of maybe $1,500, $2,000, $3,000. Because of this concession, that surcharge is gone. That's a savings you realize immediately. Mm-hmm. Secondly, and this will really baffle you when you know this, MPA seemed to be profitable. A good amount of MPA's revenue came from storage fees, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the storage fees were excessive, or people ended up paying a lot of storage fees because, not because they wanted to store their stuff there, but because in many instances the MPA didn't have adequate equipment to move their stuff out. So if I came to the port today and I want to take my stuff out, I just couldn't.
Mm-hmm. I had to wait 3, 4, 5
days, and they would, of course, they would charge you anyway. So a good portion of MPA's revenues came from storage. That's a bad business model. you are profiting off inefficiency. I mean, that's like extortion, really. Only the mob do business like that. You know, you are profiting off inefficiency. You can't run a business like that. So when you have, and I'm not suggesting here that APM chairman is perfect. I think there's some things that, you know, some teething problems, some things that will get better as we go along. And that's natural. And I think it's just a question of engaging them and seeing how things can be improved. But when you have a company that comes to you and they have a requirement, a performance bond on performance, he's saying to you, I'm sorry, take your stuff out of my... He wants to make sure that things are gone. And he's going to charge a price that he thinks the service level and investments merit. I mean, you're basically paying what you would have paid if you had this work done in the past anyway. But all things considered, there hasn't been any price increase on account of APM terminals.
Okay,
it's so a new system.
It's all negotiated.
Everything is stated explicitly in the contract. What is being charged today is something that was in the contract. APMT didn't get up one day and say, okay, I'm going to charge. Now,
okay.
I would grant that they are very stringent when it comes to, strict when it comes to their storage. Because their motto is, I want your stuff to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Please, I don't want to make money from storage. Get your stuff out of my port. That's it. As it should be,
right.
Because the port is not efficient when it's cluttered up with all containers all over the place. It's more efficient when it's clear, you get cargo in, people can pick that stuff and go, finish. That's the model that I mean, that makes sense if they're going to meet the obligations that we impose on them under this contract.
So maybe one or two, time is running out, so one or two final questions. One is, dealing with the port is such a major revenue point, And somewhat sensitive topic. There were back in 2006, at least, there were nearly 2,000 people employed at the port.
Yeah.
A large operation. How did you deal with some of the sensitivity with the reform? Did that create obstacles for you? Were there groups or individuals that tried to stop what you were doing in some way, or how did you manage those sorts of issues?
To be honest, that's one of the most difficult parts. That was one of the most difficult parts of the whole thing. I mean, you know, on the one hand, you want to do something that have, you know, far-reaching effects economically and socially, yet in the short term that would impact somewhat adversely some people. It's a difficult call. I mean, nobody wants to be in a position to make that decision, but, I mean, all things considered, one has to look at the big picture, right? I mean, I guess that's what these kinds of decision-making processes are all about. I mean, you know, you look at everything, you weigh it, and then if I end up on the balance, I think the short-term sting was worth the long-term benefits in terms of the economic, you know, gains that we think, you know, having a properly functioning port could bring about. So, hands down, going with this deal was it. But the truth is, and I don't know the numbers precisely here, but, and it doesn't make a difference either way because those people were still employed. But the labor level at the port, the number of employees at the port swelled significantly after 2003. I think, if I'm not wrong, I think in around that time, I think there were about 600 to 700 there or something like that. And just during the interim administration, it swelled to 2,000. Because it's easy to employ people at a port. It's a revenue-generating agency. Everybody wants to be employed at a port. So people would send their friends there. And that was the nature of the system as it was. I'm not in a position to judge it because I wasn't here. But that's how the numbers swelled. So you had a huge number of people, yet the port wasn't functioning properly. I don't know if you can attribute that to the number of people that were there. Sometimes it is the problem. You got too many people in the room trying to do things that doesn't work sometimes. But that was the situation as it existed, and we had to confront it head on. But as part of the overall reforms, the government itself decided to do some right sizing, right? To take off some of the labor from the port. And I think by the time we got to the concession, we had reduced the number to, I think probably about between 700 to 900. I don't know the exact numbers, but it was significantly reduced, okay? So the numbers were much smaller. And then the last group that left over basically was part of the last negotiation. Yeah, they were, you know, it came up in the hearings at the legislature. And you know, there were some protests, and rightly so. Nobody likes to lose a job. And in the end, there was some negotiated package where people were given, you know, I guess golden parachutes, if you will, or even silver parachutes, or even bronze parachutes, depending on how you look at it. But in the final analysis, it worked well. But interestingly, a good number of the very best ones were retained at APM Terminals, because APM Terminal was like, well, we are coming here. We're not going to import people from the moon to work here. If we got people here who can do it, we'll hire them. It's plain and simple. But we're not going to hire you just because you were here. We're going to hire you because you were here and you can do the job, because otherwise we won't be able to do what we need to do. So they hired a good number of people. They've been paid very, very well. I mean, comparatively. And I mean, things seem to be fine. But yes, in retrospect, if there's one thing that I could change about the whole deal, is, or that I wish I were in a position to change, was how could I do this without anybody losing their jobs? I wish I had options, right, you know, to mitigate the impact on those employees. But in the final analysis, I think the decision was right. It's a tough one, but it was the right decision, and I think we'll all benefit from it.
This leads to my final question, which is, what do you know now that you wish you knew at the beginning of this process?
I wish I knew it would have been as difficult as it was. It wasn't easy. It wasn't a walk in the park. It was a tough thing. It was a tug of war. I mean, some parts of it were tough, difficult. You have people with different interests, you know, but that's natural. You know, now, hindsight being 20/20, I can sit back in a relaxed mode and reflect on it. But, you know, I think, to be fair, I think the critical things that we needed was always there, were always there. So for the most part, I think we had everything. I think everything went as well as it possibly could have under the circumstances. If I could change one thing, it'd just be the decision-making process on some levels. Because, you know, ultimately you go to the IMCC. And that process was not as efficient as it could have been. But again, because, you know, you had a lot of people coming in and making trouble, just for the hell of it. But that only happens when you have a process that is kind of not tightly managed, or that is not open enough that everybody can kind of influence the way it goes, which to a certain extent was the way it went. But then you have to reflect and realize that this was the first deal of this kind to ever happen in this country. And this is, you know, a deal concerning a very, very important asset, national asset. So you can expect it to be difficult. Perhaps it was a little bit more difficult than it needed to be, but, you know, you one has to expect it to be difficult. So I think basically, yeah, that's about the one thing. I just wish the decision-making process were easier. But besides that, everything else, I think was a walk in the park, more or less. But just the decision-making process. When all the parts of it that I didn't have to be involved with groups on, I think was just efficient. We got it done, finished. But when you have to get a lot of different people, a lot of different agencies, a lot of different interests together to make a decision like this, a novel decision where everybody's concerned about the implications down the line, it's tough. And as I said, understandably.
Mr. Sindel, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah. Pleasure is all mine.